Welcome to SCI Science Perspectives, a broadcast brought to you by the American Spinal Injury Association. In this podcast, we'll be discussing emerging literature spanning the full spectrum of SCI research, from discovery to clinical application. You're listening to an Administrative Perspectives episode. In this annual special edition episode, we will hear from the research award winners from Asia's 2024 scientific meeting. Authors will be given approximately 5 minutes to present their award-winning work and discuss any future directions. This will be followed by a presidential handoff between Dr. Suzanne Groh and Dr. Susan Charlefieu. We hope you enjoyed the episode, and we hope to see you at next year's meeting, where you may have the opportunity to have your work presented on the podcast.
Hello to Dr. Ryan Selinsky, who was awarded the 2024 Apple Award for a project titled Transcutaneous Spinal Cord Stimulation and Its Impact on Cardiovascular Autonomic Regulation After Spinal Cord Injury. Welcome, Dr. Selinsky.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
And if you can, for our listeners, say a bit about your affiliations and titles.
Sure. I'm Ryan Selinsky. I'm a spinal cord injury medicine physician scientist at Mayo Clinic.
Fantastic. And now for our first question, can you briefly summarize, starting with the research question of your project, and then which findings you thought were most exciting?
Ooh, most exciting. It was all very exciting. So this was a kind of small randomized study using deep autonomic phenotyping to characterize the autonomic regulatory effects of transcutaneous spinal cord stim. There have been several well-done studies that have really demonstrated that spinal cord stimulation can increase blood pressure when it would normally fall during something like a tilt table test where people go up at an incline. However, it was really unclear from those studies if the blood pressure increases were due to some improved dynamic autonomic regulation where, you know, someone is tilted up and the stimulation is helping those signals from the brain get through the injured spot in their cord to help activate the sympathetic nervous system as it normally would, or if the stimulation was in fact just causing some below level pain and leading to an increase in blood pressure, similar to what we would see in autonomic dysreflexia. So in terms of exciting findings, we enrolled 4 total individuals in the study. So it was a small study, individuals with high thoracic motor sensory complete spinal cord injury, and 1-to-1 age, sex, BMI, and exercise matched controls. And then within those groups, each dyad kind of went through this baseline autonomic laboratory assessment where we looked at sympathetic activation above and below their injury level, and then sympathetic inhibition. And then we repeated those studies with the addition of transcutaneous spinal cord stimulation between T10 and T11 with at least 7 days of washout and using different frequencies. So trying to look at the effects of spinal cord stimulation frequencies specifically and how that might change the autonomic regulatory responses. So for each one of these studies, the stimulation was below motor threshold. And as mentioned, there was a washout period between each one. And what we found was that just the same as what happened on the tilt table, spinal cord stimulation helped with sympathetic activation. People needed to turn their sympathetic nervous system on, increase blood pressure, they could do that. However, when people with spinal cord injury who already had impairments in sympathetic inhibition, turning those signals off, had the spinal cord stimulation turned on, the inhibition got even worse. Also, when spinal cord stimulation was added to below level sympathetic activation, so we put people's feet in ice water, that also caused autonomic dysreflexia, whereas when we didn't have stimulation and put their feet in ice water, they did not have any AD. So taken together, this kind of deep autonomic phenotyping study really provides some important clues in terms of what spinal cord stimulation is affecting for the autonomic nervous system.
Looks great, Dr. Selinsky. So what are the next steps and future goals from this project?
Yeah, so I think the big take home in my perspective is that there does seem to be some frequency dependent assistance for above level sympathetic activation, especially at 120 hertz, which is a frequency that's being used more commonly. But we don't really know about what the long-term implications are. There's a lot of spinal cord stimulation studies that are going on right now. There's people that are using it off-label. I think we need to figure out those next steps. Lots of times, I think autonomic dysreflexia is seen as this scary entity where people have, emergent hypertension and they're at risk of stroke and, retinal hemorrhage and death. But a lot of dysreflexia is pretty mild. So we need to understand what this mild variant really does to people's bodies and what the long-term implications of that may be, to really figure out if this is something safe that people can be engaging in. And if it's not, how do we tweak it to make sure that it's something that people are going to get benefit from?
Welcome, Dr. Justine Stewart, the 2024 Early Career Best Poster Award winner. Justine, please tell us about your affiliations and the title of your project.
I am happy to. So I am Justine Stewart. I'm a clinical psychology postdoctoral fellow at Shriners Children's on the Chicago campus. And I'm going to talk today about our poster titled, Dating Satisfaction Among Adults with Pediatric Onset Spinal Cord Injuries.
Great title for the presentation. Can you tell us a bit about the project?
Yeah, I'm happy to. So our project had three goals. And the first goal, we were just interested in reporting what physical intimacy looked like among adults with pediatric onset spinal cord injuries. And let me define that for you. For us, it meant any form of intimacy that did not include penetrative sex. And that was intentional just because of a lot of the qualitative research we had been inspired by, where adults with spinal cord injuries spoke about really prioritizing non-penetrative intimacy after spinal cord injury. And then our second goal was just looking at dating satisfaction among this population. Where did people land from very dissatisfied to very satisfied? And then our third goal was to look at the relationship between those two constructs, physical intimacy frequency, and then relationship or dating satisfaction. And what we found was that half of our population reported that they had never had any form of physical intimacy or even penetrative sex in the past year. And then, kind of surprisingly, 68% reported satisfaction, meaning they were moderately or very satisfied or very satisfied with their dating life. And then we found that 14% of that dating satisfaction was explained by the past year physical intimacy frequency. Another thing we explored, kind of because we were curious, was the prevalence of the use of sexual aids. And we decided to keep that broad, so we didn't narrow participants down to what kind of aid. And we found that only one in three, so around like 35% of people, had reported ever using a form of any sexual aid following their spinal cord injury. And I'll just remind you that this is the pediatric onset folks, so people who acquired their spinal cord injury before the age of 19.
Thanks so much, Justine. So, what are the next steps based on this project?
So one of the lingering questions is, who are these nevos? Who are the people that say, who are the 50% of the population who say that they have never had any form of physical intimacy or penetrative sex in the past year? We're wondering, are those people, is there an overrepresentation of quadriplegia among that population? Can we predict who those nevos are based on their level of education or employment? Who are they? And then I think another next step for the audience and anyone interested in this topic would be to read our paper, which is called Sexual Activity Among Adults with Pediatric Onset Spinal Cord Injury, Injury Demographic and Lifestyle Factors. And that was part of kind of a special edition on sexual functioning, fertility, and pregnancy in topics in spinal cord injury. So definitely, if you're interested and want to learn more, that's a good resource.
Hello to Dr. Anne Bryden. She's the second place winner in the Oral Talk Award for a project titled Transitions in Care After SCI: Impacts of Hidden Work on Support Persons. Welcome, Dr. Bryden.
Hi, thank you for having me. I am an occupational therapist and sociologist. I am Associate Professor of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation at the Metro Health Center for Rehabilitation Research. That's in Cleveland, Ohio. I also have an appointment at Case Western Reserve University in the School of Medicine, Department of PM&R, again, also in Cleveland, Ohio.
Perfect. So, Dr. Bryden, Can you give us a brief summary of the research question that your project addressed and what you thought were the most exciting findings?
Sure. So this project is actually part of a larger project that's entitled Psychosocial Impacts on Caregivers to Individuals with Spinal Cord Injury. It's a project funded by the Craig H. Nielsen Foundation. And the specific objective that we were looking at for the presentation at Asia was really to investigate the experiences encountered by support people to individuals with spinal cord injury as they negotiate the many transitions in care that can happen during the first year after spinal cord injury. The background behind this is really things that I discovered while doing my dissertation work, which was completed back in 2020, where we realized people were dealing with quite a lot of, you know, a lot in addition to just dealing with their bodily and emotional changes after spinal cord injury. So the acts of trying to find resources and facilitators to get back into the community really took a large amount of time and had significant impacts on the support people to people with spinal cord injury. So the project in general, what we decided to do, our approach was to do in-depth, semi-structured interviews with 15 people with spinal cord injury and their identified support people or caregivers. And we did those interviews starting right at the time of the person's injury when they arrived in acute inpatient rehab. And then we repeated the interviews with support people at 6 months and 12 months post-injury. And really, a lot of the things that we asked during the interviews had to do with the support person's experiences immediately after their loved one's injury, whether or not they had an understanding of what happened, their person's eligibility for government benefits, perhaps any other experiences they may have had around disability or illness or injury or even the US healthcare system. We spent a lot of time querying the things that they would do on behalf of their person with spinal cord injury, what things, you know, were of their greatest concerns and, you know, things that would help them right at that moment in time. And so what we discovered actually is there were a lot of themes that arose. We recorded all of the interviews and, you know, did our you know, qualitative approach of, you know, coding and identifying themes. And really, people brought up a number of different problems, barriers to seeking information about rehab centers, for example, or coordinating home modifications. And a big part of what came up really had to do with what we call beneficiary work and hidden work. So beneficiary work is really the kind of work that someone would do to find out what things they're eligible for. So this stems from work done by other scholars who looked at Medicaid resources and, you know, how people went about finding out what they're eligible for having and what they have access to. And what we found is there's a broader category of hidden work that support people were facing after their loved one had a spinal cord injury. And the type of work changed over the year during which we spoke with individuals. So what we found with what support people were sharing with us is that they had a significant amount of what we call invisible family load. So the things that are required of them to manage their lives, the lives of their person with injury. And this was from Wayne and colleagues who really dove into this topic, and it stems back to differences in gender roles. But we're finding that our support people to people with spinal cord injury not only had all of the planning and organizing, but they also had to have attention to things and understanding schedules and worrying about the rest of the family, making sure that everyone's well-being was cared for, and having to attend to that emotionally, cognitively, in addition to any kind of physical work, was really trying for individuals.
Great findings, Dr. Bryden. So tell us, what do these lead to? What are the next steps?
Well, as I always jokingly refer to, is it's very hard to make big changes in policy. So I feel that the results from this study gives us some ideas of where to go in as far as impacting new policies. However, we really do have to help the people before the revolution happens, right? So what we're doing with this project is creating a website and making it a useful resource for not just support people to people with spinal cord injury, but also people with spinal cord injury themselves in knowing what questions to ask. So much of our data showed that people after this injury didn't even know where to begin or what to ask. And if this website does that at a bare minimum, I think we'll have won. There's a lot of great resources out there for people with spinal cord injury, but no real clearinghouse. So we'll be kind of developing this website and hopefully getting it up by the end of the summer and really disseminating it as broadly as we can to help people find their way after this injury.
And for our listeners, where will they be able to find the website? Do you have a working title yet?
I have a working title, but I didn't purchase the domain yet. That's happening imminently. So to be announced.
Let us know, Doc, and we'll help spread the word.
Thank you. Absolutely.
Can you introduce yourself, your affiliations and titles?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you for having me. My name is James Crispo. I'm a postdoctoral research fellow in the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia. I'm also a ICOR trainee in Vancouver. Additionally to those roles, I do hold a role as a stipendary faculty member at NOSM University. Prior to beginning my fellowship, I completed a PhD in population health. And then prior to that, I formally trained as a biochemist and spent some time working for Health Canada, so for our federal government. And for the last decade or so, I've been working really on applied epidemiology, looking at health service utilization and outcomes, primarily among populations affected by neurological disease and spinal cord injury.
Great, and tell us about your project.
Absolutely. So the project that we presented this past year at the Asia Annual Scientific Meeting was titled Nationwide Emergency Department Visits for Pediatric Traumatic Spinal Cord Injury in the United States. From 2016 to 2020. Now, this particular study that we presented was published last November in a special issue in Frontiers in Neurology. And what it does is it builds on our team's prior experience looking at inpatient traumatic SCI in the US and builds on some of our existing work in the province of Ontario using administrative claims data. And the real motivation for this particular work really stemmed from a study that was published back in 2014 based on ICD-9 coding, looking at a pediatric traumatic SCI in the U.S. And there's a particular statistic that really stood out, at least for me in that study, and that was that 20% of children that visit the emergency department for a traumatic SCI are discharged home. And that's something, again, as a non-clinician applied epidemiologist, really kind of resonated with me, and I wanted to kind of further understand what was taking place or what was going on in that particular context, particularly following the introduction of ICD-10. So that brings us to kind of the objectives of our particular study, and that was to describe national trends in incident emergency department visits for traumatic SCI among children in the US, and to determine the proportion of visits that resulted in immediate hospitalization each year, including by age and sex. And secondarily, we wanted to examine associations between select characteristics, so things like individual patient factors or care setting factors, and their association with being hospitalized following traumatic SCI. And then further, we wanted to look at the subgroup of children that presented with sports-related traumatic SCI, so to better understand what that looked like over time, as well as by region. In terms of methods, so we leveraged what was called the Healthcare Cost and Utilization Project dataset, specifically the Nationwide Emergency Department sample from 2016 to 2020. And first, what we did is we identified ICD-10 diagnoses for an initial traumatic spinal cord injury. And to do so, we used a grouper. So this was called a clinical classification software, which took, you know, the thousands of ICD-10 codes, broke them down into about 530 clinically meaningful categories across 22 body systems. And what we did is we were able to take those codes describing initial traumatic SCI and identify visits for those episodes. Now, the real strength of this particular data set is that it can actually be weighted to produce nationally representative estimates of care. So that was, you know, that was really, really helpful to better understand more broadly what was taking place in the US. And then we were able to use Census Bureau data to approximate annual rates of ED visits per 100,000 children. In terms of the outcomes, so I've mentioned we were interested in looking at ED visit rates over time. That was really our primary outcome. The secondary outcome was to explore the hospitalizations. Now, these included admission to the same hospital, as well as transfers to other short-term hospitals. To explore the associations between the characteristics that I mentioned and hospitalization, we conducted or we built unconditional logistic regression models. So we built a multivariable logistic model here with covariates that were determined a priori to potentially be confounders. So these included things like age, sex, race, primary payer, or the hospital where the child presented was a trauma level hospital. So including rather their designation of trauma level. And I mentioned the subgroup. So the subgroup here was really important. So these were the children that presented with sport related injuries. To identify sport related injuries, we used a grouper, a classification of sports according to contact. And this is a grouper that was developed by the American Academy of Pediatric Counsel on Sports Medicine and Fitness. So moving right into the results. So what we saw over time between 2016 and 2020 was that on average, there were about 2,200 visits for traumatic SCI among children, which corresponded to a rate of about 2.55 visits per 100,000 children per year. And I think the real notable finding here is that both the absolute number of visits as well as the corresponding rates were relatively stable over time. And now here's where it gets a little bit interesting is that we saw, again, on average across the study period, 72.6% of the visits resulted in immediate hospitalization. Or kind of taken another way, upwards of 30% of children were being discharged home. When we look by age and sex, we did see some differences there as well. Unsurprisingly, the oldest children represented about 70% of all ED visits. And despite the youngest children, so those being age 0 to 4, having the lowest average number of ED visits, they had the highest average annual hospitalization rate. So this kind of mirrored what we saw among older kids. When we look at differences by sex, again, very kind of similar to what we would expect, whereby males relative to females had about a twofold or double the number of hospitalizations absolute per year, as well as a corresponding rate. When we looked at factors associated with immediate hospitalization, we saw that relative to the oldest children, younger children, so particularly those between the ages of 5 and 14, were less likely to be immediately hospitalized. And then relative to trauma level 1 center, children presenting to non-trauma centers were less likely to be hospitalized. And I think I really want to emphasize that these modeling were very much exploratory in nature. So we have to be cautious in terms of interpreting the findings and kind of over extrapolating, any meaning behind those. Now, when we look at the actual sports related subgroup, we saw that within our sample, about 17% of ED visits resulted or were attributed to sport related injuries. So a little over 400 visits per year. And when we, again, unsurprisingly, so these were really driven by contact or collision or very limited contact type of injuries. When we look over time, so between, let's say, 2019 and 2020, so the year immediately before the pandemic and the first year of the pandemic, we saw about a 36.5% decrease in the absolute number of sport-related injuries. And consistently across the board, without question, American tackle football was a leading cause of sport-related injury among children. So, collectively, what does this all mean? We demonstrate that the rates of ED visits, as well as the absolute number of visits, are relatively stable for traumatic SCI among kids over time, which is a good thing, assuming that there aren't additional efficiencies to be made, so we can actually drive that kind of rate down lower. Now, the actual differences in terms of hospitalization likely reflect underlying differences in mechanism, pathology, et cetera. And it's really, important to emphasize that further reductions may be possible, again, unclear, but likely possible through further investment in public policies, education, and prevention initiatives. And it is important to mention that some key limitations here. It's that these are all based, or the identification of these visits are based on ICD-10 coding. So it is possible that there is misclassification or either, over or underestimating these respective counts and the corresponding rates. And I think the other big limitation here is that there is no validated traumatic SCI case definition. So, whether that's for children or all populations, it's really something that ought to be done moving forward.
Great. And what are the next steps and future goals for your project?
Yeah, so that's an excellent question. So as I mentioned, the development of a validated case ascertainment algorithm would be, you know, very much crucial to do, whether that's for children or kind of all populations. The other piece is to very much describe traumatic SCI care pathways. And this is a real interest of our particular group. As I mentioned, we are doing some of this work in Ontario now. And what we're seeing is that what you might assume in terms of documentation of an SCI in the eMERGE, then following through to an inpatient setting, we don't see that those are documented consistently. And what do I mean by that? I mean that if you accrue a cohort in an inpatient setting, you may potentially be missing some children with TSCI. And then if you were to accrue based on an emergency department algorithm, you might also miss some children. So in Ontario, for example, we're seeing that less than 50% of TSCI visits lead or result in a hospitalization. And of those hospitalized, you know, less than half of those visits actually have the TSCI documented in the inpatient setting. But I think we need to do some additional work in terms of characterizing the care pathways. We also need to better understand the etiologies resulting in pediatric traumatic SCI. And I think, you know, of great importance, we need to further assess the effectiveness both of existing as well as new interventions aimed at traumatic SCI prevention.
Welcoming Lewis Lucas, 2024 Oral Talk Award, third place winner. Lewis, please introduce yourself.
So I'm Lewis. I'm a PhD candidate at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Zurich, Switzerland. And I'm a PhD candidate in the Biomedical Data Science Lab of Professor Catherine Yutzler.
Good luck with your dissertation studies. So Lewis, tell us here now about the project for which you were awarded at Asia's 24 meeting.
So in our work, and more specifically in my PhD, we're looking to expand the use of advanced or state-of-the-art machine learning methods in spinal cord injury research. And one of the prime examples of a very interesting task to look at is recovery prediction. So we're interested if we can predict accurately and precisely the neurological status or function abilities of affected individuals using just information from the acute phase. And we would feed that information from the acute phase into machine learning models and compare these on their performance. So how well do they basically predict what motor function or function status looks like at 6 to 12 months? So in spinal cord injury, I guess we're aware that there's relatively little data. So we tried to make use of existing knowledge about the condition to actually help these more advanced models to learn with this relatively small amount of data available. And so a common prediction task that's often addressed, like I said, is neurological status. And commonly though, in the field, this is only predicted using very few pieces of information. So typical models might, for example, look at low extremity motor score and a couple of covariates like age, sex, potentially neurological level of injury. But what we are trying to do is actually represent the information from the INSCI exam in much more detail. And so we wanted to look at the full sequence of motor and potentially also sensory scores and represent this in a way that a model can actually use it. And one way to go about this is use something called graphs. So graphs are mathematical objects which essentially allow you to represent entities and relationships between entities explicitly. And so the way we went about this is we represented every myotome in the motor score sequence as a single entity in such a graph, and we connected adjacent myotomes. So we would connect myotomes on the left and the right, and also basically above and below. So you would connect C5 to C6, for example, but also C5 on the left and the right. And so with this representation of the motor score sequence, we train a graph neural network. So this is essentially a combination of this graph concept with something you might be familiar with from imaging or language processing research, where you have these deep neural networks, which essentially can almost perfectly approximate any function, at least in theory. And this function in our case would be this connection between acute and chronic injury state. And so in this presentation, I showed our preliminary results, which tried this graph-based concept and compared with another standard approach that doesn't have access to this explicit representation. So essentially, this comparison or this comparator model would just get the same motor and sensory scores, but just in a tabular format. So it would have no idea about this relationship between adjacent myotomes. And we hypothesized that using this explicit representation would improve results. And luckily for us, this was also the case. The improvement wasn't huge, but it was significant, or it was clear across both injury severities and also for the population as a whole.
Really exciting results there. So what are the future directions from this project?
So in the future, there are a few things that we would like to try. One thing, of course, is to potentially get access to more data. So we were working with data from the European Multicenter Study about Spinal Cord Injury, which is one of the large observational databases. But of course, there are other efforts, similar efforts going on. And of course, potentially merging these data sources would be something that would be very interesting to see if our concept translates across data sources, but also what can be potentially done if we increase the data size available. We would also like to potentially test alternative structures of these graphs. So currently we have a very simple representation where we simply go by adjacency, but of course the knowledge about the anatomy and physiology of the spinal cord is much more advanced than this. And graphs would in theory allow you to represent such information. And that would be something that could be very interesting to test if this more anatomically correct or representative graph concept would work better. And then finally, we'd also like to look at additional data modalities. So currently we're just looking at motor and sensory scores as assessed by the INSCI. But of course, the interest in biomarkers is growing, and these graphs can in theory also deal with heterogeneous data. So for example, if blood marker or CSF marker information was available, we could integrate this and see if it makes a difference and improves predictions hopefully a little bit further again.
We have Dr. Alicia Vos, who won second place for best poster. Dr. Vos, can you please introduce yourself, your affiliations and titles?
Sure. Yeah, my name is Alicia Vos, and I am an assistant professor of neurology at the University of Florida in Jacksonville. I am a full-time researcher, and I tell you a little bit of my background. I actually was a speech pathologist by training. I practiced clinically for about 6 years before going back and getting my PhD to study swallowing function. So that's sort of my area of expertise, is I study the upper airway. I'm really interested in the larynx and the way that we protect our airway when we're eating and drinking and coordinating swallowing with breathing. So I have a lab here now at the University of Florida where I study upper airway function in spinal cord injury, but also all different types of neurologic diseases, so stroke and traumatic brain injury. But of course, here today, we're here to talk about spinal cord injury, which is kind of a new area of my lab and research interest. So I'm really excited to talk about it.
Awesome. Please tell us about your project.
Yeah. So like I said, I study upper airway function and particularly swallowing and airway protection. And just a little background, because this is probably something many have not thought about very much, but when we swallow, one of the goals or one of the things that happens when we swallow is we want to protect any of that food or liquid from getting into the lungs. And we do that by closing the larynx when we swallow. It happens super fast. You probably don't think about it because we're kind of breathing, swallowing, and the larynx is moving really fast to make sure that none of that liquid or food gets into the airway. And one of the things that we've established, even in my own lab, is that even really subtle deficits in that closure mechanism during swallowing can lead to episodes of what we call aspiration. And that's just a term that means that something is getting into the lungs that shouldn't be there. And this is really important because we know that if we aspirate sort of chronically and or more frequently than just, you know, you take a sip of, you know, Coke or something that goes down the wrong way, that's happened to all of us, we're not going to get pneumonia, right? But if that happens a little more frequently over time, we can get respiratory infections and namely pneumonia. And one of the reasons why I became really interested in spinal cord injury patients and in the community and research is because I would go to a lot of talks on spinal cord injury, and there was one statistic that I always heard, which was that, you know, is kind of one of the leading slides, which is respiratory complications are one of the leading causes of death after spinal cord injury. And that's particularly in cervical spinal cord injury, where pneumonia can count for, I think the stat is like 58% of deaths in higher cervical injuries, like C1 to C4. Pneumonia is really prevalent. It can be really life-threatening, and it's a real focus of conversation in mitigating the effects of pneumonia in this population. And a lot of times this is kind of attributed to like ventilatory failure, and we know that a lot of patients with spinal cord injury have respiratory deficits and poor cough function. And I had one question, and that question was, well, how well do they protect their airway after a spinal cord injury? Has anybody looked at you know, when they're eating or drinking or just swallowing their saliva? Is some of that getting into the lungs? And it was like crickets. And I said, I really want to study this. We need to know more about that. Like, this is really prevalent in spinal cord injury. So this was kind of my gateway into being really interested and passionate about patients that have had spinal cord injury, and wanting to look at changes in laryngeal function after injury, how breathing is coordinated with swallowing. And, you know, one of the main pieces in this study that I presented at ASIA was looking at a cohort. And this is kind of a small study, just like a pilot study to kind of get a sense of what, you know, are there deficits, or, you know, what's happening. As we say, sort of under the hood, swallowing is hard to study because we have to use X-ray videos. It's called video fluoroscopy to really look at how those cartilages move and how the muscles move when we're eating and drinking. And so we looked at this in about 15 community dwelling adults with chronic cervical spinal cord injury. And I highlight chronic because there is data, and we do know a little bit about swallowing problems and airway protection in acute spinal cord injury. And we know that oftentimes patients can have, it's what we call dysphagia, and that just is a fancy word that means swallowing impairment. But the thing about acute spinal cord injury, and when it's studied in acute spinal cord injury, is that a lot of times those changes are kind of transient, and it can be due to things like, not surprisingly, someone's had a breathing tube in their throat for a while, or while they're in the ICU, they're on a lot of medications, or there can be swelling near the spinal cord and in the prevertebral tissue, and that can make it really difficult to swallow. But this isn't really unique to spinal cord injury. It's actually pretty unique to anybody that's been in the ICU and has had a breathing tube in for a long period of time. It can cause these sort of transient changes in swallowing function. But I was really interested in, well, do those deficits persist? You know, after they leave the ICU, they go to acute rehab, and they're kind of in that chronic phase of a year out of injury or beyond. Do those deficits resolve? Or maybe are there changes in the ability to protect their airway over time that can have, that may be under-recognized, or maybe it's a profound complication of spinal injury that can contribute to some of these high respiratory infection rates that we're just not really appreciating or understanding. So in my lab, we use video fluoroscopy as a tool, and that's really it's just an X-ray video. We have patients eat and drink different consistencies, and it's laced with a contrast called barium, so we can actually see the liquid move through the whole body as you swallow. And when you swallow that, we can see, we have all these, you know, fancy tools to look at, well, how quickly does the airway close and how long does it stay closed? And is some of it going down the wrong way? And so we looked at that in 15 patients with spinal cord injury. And these were actually relatively very healthy individuals that, you know, they're community dwelling, they're active in their community, they're not in any sort of oxygen support. And we just wanted to get a sense of what that looked like when we compare it to sort of age and gender matched non-injured controls. And it was really interesting looking at the data because what we found is that even in individuals that are quite high functioning, what we see is that the airway takes a little bit longer to close than age and gender match non-injure control. So, compared to like you or I, and it seems so subtle, but the interesting thing about swallowing is really subtle deficits in how quickly you close your airway can lead to these like chronic transient micro aspiration episodes. And that's what we saw in a portion of our patients. We saw, I think it was 4 out of 15 aspirated during the exam, but it was silent aspiration. And what I mean by that is that a little bit of liquid got down into the lungs, but they had no awareness of it. There was no, sort of sensation in the way that if you or I, if something goes down the wrong way, I mean, we're going to sit here and cough up a lung for the next 5 minutes, right? It's going to be a really aggressive response. So there was something about that, the sensory aspect that was blunted, and also just those subtle deficits in that airway closure, was, kind of opened our eyes to like, wow, maybe this is something that we should be looking at and considering in this population. So we look at things like, when you swallow, the airway should be closed for a certain period of time to make sure, all the food and liquid gets into the esophagus and stomach before you breathe again. And like I said, that was a little shorter and it took a little bit longer to close. And it was just that those little changes that caused the aspiration in these individuals. So this is pretty eye-opening to me. And like I said, I mean, this is sort of a pilot study to just generate hypotheses. We want to study this in a much bigger population of patients with, diverse injuries, with varying levels of baseline respiratory deficits, and really try to characterize why is this happening? What is really the root cause? Is it something that happened in the acute stage of injury when they were in the ICU? Is it something from the breathing tube? Are they having difficulty coordinating breathing and swallowing because we know they have those respiratory deficits? So this is just really kind of like a glimpse into, gosh, maybe these patients are getting pneumonia for a multitude of reasons that's not just related to cough function and respiratory deficits. But this is really important in spinal injury because we know many of these patients have really weak cough. So even if something goes down the wrong way, you or I are able to give a nice strong cough and kind of expel that material, protect the lungs. But gosh, when you have a spinal injury and your cough function is impaired, when something goes down the wrong way, there's just multi-layers of an inability to really protect those lungs and keep infections out and keep that protected.
And any other next steps and future goals?
Yeah, I mean, I think that this was really just like the very beginning of what I hope is a deep dive into better understanding many things. One is, of course, we want to study this in a much larger sample size, and we're actively, putting in grants into right now to try to get funding to study this in a larger population. We want to look at what are the mechanisms of these impairments. So I have some really fabulous colleagues. I'm a clinical researcher. I work only with humans, but I have great colleagues that are basic scientists that are able to work with me to look at what are some of the underlying mechanisms, looking at like rodent models and stuff to better understand, is this from the spinal injury itself? Is it from something mechanical that happens acutely? So we really want to just understand like what is happening? How do we prevent this? To look at the impact of breathing severity on airway protection abilities, and just understand what are the risk factors. How do these changes, do they change over time? Or, what can we do? Ultimately, my goal, I'm a therapist at heart before I'm a scientist, is we can't fix it if we don't know why it's happening, or are we unaware that it's happening. So the goal is to understand, Is this happening in a larger population? And are there things that we could do earlier on to prevent aspiration, to prevent pneumonia? And, not to be pie in the sky, but my hope is, gosh, it would be great if this is contributing to pneumonia in these populations and we can fix it. That's huge for these patients. Pneumonia is devastating. Having even just having pneumonia and not being able to kind of cough up some of those secretions and have those normal mechanisms to clear the airway, it's devastating. And so my goal and a huge piece of my research program in my lab now is to dive into this and understand, what patients are at higher risk, how do we fix it?
Today we have Dr. Angela Phelous, who is the third place 2024 poster award winner. Welcome, Dr. Phelous. Can you please introduce yourself, your affiliations and titles?
Yeah, I'm Dr. Angela Phelous. I am a research scientist at The Ohio State University in Columbus, Ohio, in the Department of Neurology.
Tell us about your project.
Yeah, so after spinal cord injury, patients become severely immune compromised, making them highly susceptible to infections. And unfortunately, for many patients, these infections become lethal, making acquired infections and acquired pneumonia in particular the leading cause of death after spinal cord injury. But what I found interesting was that if you were to look at patients with and without infections and compare their locomotor recovery potential for those who survive those infections, we can see that patients with infections have worse neurological recovery compared to patients who never had an infection in that early stage after injury. And this persists even a year out after the injury. And so the question was really, what is happening to the hardware in the spinal cord that might be driving these neurological deficits? So as we can imagine, if we can sort of protect that neurological recovery potential for those patients, we might be able to preserve a lot of life-changing or significant quality of life improvement for those patients. And so we developed a mouse model where we give them pneumonia directly into their lungs and look at their recovery over time. And what we found, similar to what we see in humans, is that we do drive a higher mortality rate in these animals. So when they get the infections, a lot of them do die. But when we look at the mice that survive, and we use locomotor recovery tests such as the BMS scale, we can see that these animals actually have reduced and delayed functional recovery, which was mimicking what we had seen in the human condition. So suggesting that these infections really do drive that impaired locomotor recovery that we observe in the human population. So we thought, okay, we've really established this clinical model. And so what we did is we took the tissue from the animals, and what we have found is a very profound amount of bleeding that happens in the spinal cord. So these infections really drive bleeding both at the site of injury, but also if we looked in areas further out from the lesion center, we see an exacerbated amount of bleeding in those regions as well. So we believe that we have established sort of a correlation of where these infections are driving this exacerbated lesion through hemorrhagic transformation, both at the site of injury and throughout the spinal cord. And we believe that that's really leading to that locomotor impairment.
Thank you. And what are the next steps and future goals of your project?
Yeah, so we've just completed some RNA sequencing, which we hope to use to try to target some new signaling pathways that might be involved in triggering this hemorrhagic transformation. But I think even more importantly, translationally, we can now use this model to test different strategies to in a two-pronged way. So either to reduce the amount of infection at the site of injury by improving immune competency in these animals, but we can also try to target that hemorrhaging at the site of injury. So downstream effects, how can we apply some neuroprotective strategies that otherwise had been thought to not be effective long-term after injury, but maybe now we've opened up a new window where we can test these neuroprotection strategies after infections to really improve care for these patients. So,
hello, listeners. Thank you for listening to our 2024 Asia Scientific Meeting Award winners. We hope this encourages you to submit your work for next year's meeting. Next, we'll have Dr. Suzanne Groh and Dr. Susan Charlefieux for the presidential handoff. Dr. Groh will review Asia's accomplishments during her presidency, and Dr. Charlefieux will discuss her goals for Asia during her tenure.
So here we are, SCI Science Perspectives, podcast brought to you by the American Spinal Injury Association, cutting edge of discovery to clinical application in spinal cord injury. And we're here with both of the, well, the incoming president and the outgoing president at the 2024 American Spinal Injury Association annual scientific meeting in Puerto Rico. Beautiful setting. So speaking to you, Dr. Groh, if you can very briefly introduce yourself and then answer this one question. Just what was the most unexpected thing that happened during your presidency?
Well, I'll introduce myself first as I try to think of that at the same time. So my name is Suzanne Groh. I'm a physician. I am at MedStar National Rehab Hospital in Washington, D.C. I'm a PM&R doc, and I also run the research program there. So I've been the Asia president since 2022. What is the most unexpected thing I encountered during my presidency? I don't know. That's actually a hard one because I sort of went into it thinking that all this stuff was going to pop up and, you know, there would be surprises. And things happen and things do pop up, but nothing, I guess nothing was terrible. Let's put it that way. One of the, you know.
Could be unexpectedly good.
Yeah. I mean, I guess one of the pleasant surprises was the how kind of welcoming the membership was of my leadership style. So when I came in, I was, you know, a little bit nervous because I didn't feel like I looked like the typical president. You know, as a woman, I never wear like a skirt and a suit. I don't dress like like often, you know,
for
the female leaders do.
For the listeners, the doctor is currently not in scrubs, but she...
Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, I mentioned it during the opening session, but I realized very quickly, and I learned, and it was a, you know, I think a learning on my part, sort of from the membership, that the only way I was going to be able to do this well was to sort of be myself. But it was a pleasant surprise that, you know, I felt very, very, very much accepted, which was great.
Anything you're particularly proud of?
Actually, a lot of stuff. I mean, and some of the stuff happened over the course of when I was on the officer track. So, for example, going back before the presidency in 2019, we very unexpectedly heard that topics in spinal cord injury rehab may go out of business as a journal. So I think I was secretary treasurer at the time, but I did an evaluation. We sort of did a business evaluation very, very quickly, and then the board of directors decided to purchase the journal. So I'm very proud of that because I felt like if we lose a source of education, that would just be a great loss to the field. I'm really proud of getting through our strategic plan. I'm really proud of all the work we did in primary care. I'm really proud. I did not do this work, but I had a little light the fire role in the beginning of getting the Americas Committee going and rolling. And trust me, after that, they just took off and you know, drove that ship without anyone's help. But yeah, I mean, it's, I feel good.
Fantastic. Okay, to you, Dr. Charlefieu.
Well, I'm Susie Charlefieu, Susan Charlefieu, but I've gone by Susie forever. I am a sociologist by training. I'm at Craig Hospital. I've been there for 48 years, so longer than Suzanne has been alive, pretty much. I joined Asia, I believe, in 1989, and became involved with the program committee and a variety of other things. Love it. This is my home organization. It is a fun organization. When I first joined Asia, it was a lot of suits, a lot of men, very few women, certainly no women in leadership. And then things changed over the years with Dr. Sipsky and Dr. Jackson becoming presidents, and then MJ Mulcahy. So there's a nice legacy of really powerful women to follow, and that's made it both intimidating and exciting for me.
And with this handoff, there was a first in terms of female leadership, right?
Yes, female to female leadership, which may become something that happens again in the future down the road. So that was very exciting. There's a lot to be accomplished. It is, at this point, I'm kind of a little deer in the headlights because there's been so much that's been done. Suzanne's been such a tremendous leader and so energetic. And I'm thinking, well, she didn't leave anything for me to do. But I think there will be plenty. I really want to focus a lot on the young people, the new blood in the organization, get them involved, get them excited, let them realize how much fun it really is. And I really want to get people with lived experience much more involved in our committee work and into leadership positions. And I also want to see us not only be the premier spinal cord injury organization in the United States and in many parts of the world, but for us to partner with other very good spinal cord injury organizations where we have consistent missions, consistent goals. We're all treating the same group of people or working with the same group of people, and I think we can do it together in a collegial way, whether it becomes something like joint meetings or other joint endeavors. I mean, the international standards really was, even though it's an Asia product, and it is, there was a huge input from the International Spinal Cord Society as well. So these types of joint endeavors benefit all of us. So I'd like to see us become a bit more collegial while we still maintain our very unique and prominent identity.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. I look forward mm-hmm. to following that leadership mm-hmm. as a member. If you had one wish during your presidency, having not gone through it, what are you anticipating that your wish would be if it were to come true?
That's a tough one. It was easier to answer a question about ice cream. I think my one wish would be that we do form very tight alliances with our partner organizations and that they are beneficial to all of us, that they're done in a very good spirit of positivity, non-competitiveness, and with the goal in mind of creating the best educational products, the best research that we can offer to people with spinal cord injuries and their families. That would be one dream. I think it's achievable. I really do. And also incorporating the participation, very lively participation of people with lived experience.
Mm-hmm. That's great. None
that
of us
one
are
I
genies.
Think it's achievable.
Absolutely. None of us are genies, but dear listeners, let's help our leadership there to achieve these goals. That's great. And as outgoing president, Dr. Grow, do you have any advice for the incoming?
Enjoy yourself. I mean, we are really, really lucky. So for this meeting in Puerto Rico this year, for the first time, I brought my family. So my husband came, both my kids came, and everyone is struck by, like, how warm and welcoming everyone is toward each other. I mean, we've had several discussions about this and how unique it is. And I think we have been in the organization for a while, and like, absolutely, I don't think we take it for granted, but I think we're used to it. I mean, we look forward to the meeting not only for the science, but also to see quote close unquote friends that we see once a year and we only see them here. But I have had like so many great conversations, and so my advice to Susie is, before this, I wasn't one that was really super proactive about going out during the meeting and having conversations with people. But when I became president, I said, I'm going to go talk to as many people as I could. And that has been awesome, actually, just learning about people, getting to know them. But, you know, it's also been a bit self-serving because I've got some really good professional contacts now and a lot of contacts that can probably help build my research. So that's been great.
Lovely.
Mm-hmm.
And as our final question here, Dr. Charlefieu, do you have any statements you want to make to Asia's membership at the start of your presidency here?
Well, expect to hear from me, especially the newer and younger members, because I will be out to talk to all of you. I really intend to do that. I'm probably going to drive our front office crazy because I'm going to ask for emails of all of you, and you will be hearing from me. First of all, just to introduce myself to you and have you introduce yourselves to me and to find out where your areas of interest lie and how we can get you more involved in Asia. I intend to be very active in reaching out to people. I don't have the same clinical connections that Suzanne has, but as a sociologist, I'm interested in seeing how people work together, and that will be my goal, is to see how we can encourage people, get them involved. Even the quiet loners can get involved. I'm very much more a quiet loner than most people, and this is such a fun group. And Suzanne's right, you come to these meetings and it's like coming to a family reunion. There's a lot of hugging that goes on, a lot of chit-chat, a lot of very good professional talking as well as personal talking, and it's really a lot of fun. It's a very warm group, probably more so than any group I've ever belonged to.
Yeah. By the way, I love your goal, like reaching out to everyone by email. I mean, that is awesome, and I don't think anyone's really ever done it before. And if I have, I'm sorry if I insulted people. But
well, I might make a few. I know everybody doesn't want things getting dumped in their email boxes, but I'll try to make this a short and sweet introduction to them and make them want to respond back.
Oh, but it's a great message.
And if they don't, I will chase them down.
Yeah, but it's a great message.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I remember back my first couple years at the Asia meeting, if I would have gotten the message from the president, I would not have worried at all about one more email in my email box. Would have opened that up quickly.
That is my plan.
I second that. All right. Absolute pleasure, ladies, and thank you for joining us on this episode.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
That was fun.